Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and on to changes in society and the world. My name is Andy Pullane. I'm a service design and innovation consultant, coach, trainer, and writer. My guest today is Jorge Arango, a consultant, author, speaker, and educator, and host of The Informed Life, a podcast that explores how people organize information to get things done, and which I was also a guest. Jorge is the co-author of the famous Polar Bear book, Information Architecture for the Web and Beyond, that he co-wrote with Lou Rosenfeld and Peter Morville. More recently, he published Living in Information, Responsible Design for Digital Places. Jorge, welcome to Power of 10.
It's a pleasure to be here, Andy. I'm a big fan of the show.
I'm a big fan of yours, too. Now, we've had a few conversations that have, you know, spun off in all these kind of interconnected directions. And, you know, as an organizing information guy, you probably have some thoughts on where to start. But I guess I would like to start chronologically in a way and ask you how you're interested in this field developed in the first place.
My background has two threads that became unexpectedly woven, interwoven with each other. One thread was computers, which I was exposed to at a very young age. I like to say that people of our vintage, and I think that you and I are more or less age peers. I like to think that people of our vintage are part of the first generation that grew up with computers as playthings.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate to be exposed to computers at a very early age. And the other thread is architecture, which is what I studied at university, which has gone on to really inform my worldview in many ways. And what happened to me is that I graduated just at the time when the World Wide Web was about to come on the scene. And when the web happened, I essentially left my career in architecture to devote myself to making things online. And it was a return to this childhood interest, if not outright obsession, with computers. And I became very interested in how we structure information spaces. So if you think of architects as being designers who structure spaces for us to do certain things in the physical world, people who design websites, apps, and other digital systems are, in a sense, designing spaces where we get certain things done. We pay our bills, we learn, we do all of these things. So that's my background, and it's how I essentially came to do what I do now.
Where was the sort of first time when you started kind of combining those things professionally there?
The first time was before, like I said, before the web, I was studying architecture. And again, I'm saying so much about my age in this conversation.
We must be very similar. I was 50 this year.
So. There you go. So very similar age.
I
was a student, an architecture student, at a time when architects would still draw plans and such by hand. But that period was just about to end. You could see computers already taking over. And when I was in university, we started using computers for 3D modeling and such. And my interest in computers had never waned, really, but I hadn't been as obsessive about them as I had been in my, you know, in my youth and in my early teens. But it was really through the emergence of the computer as a tool for architectural practice that I got involved with computing again. And using computers to model 3D spaces is where the two worlds initially collided for me, which is very interesting to me to see what's been happening over the last few years with things like virtual reality and augmented reality, and how computer modeling of 3D spaces has, for example, taken over the movies. I was having a discussion on one of the social networks a couple of days ago about a new Universal Studios theme park that's opening in Beijing. And I was saying that I wonder to what degree the experience of those movie making theme parks is as relevant now that all movie making happens in computers, right? Like, it's like visiting the sets and stuff is not as interesting when it's all green screens.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's weird. You visit a kind of facsimile or a kind of a sort of made up version of the set that it would be. It's like, you know, you build the set in the computer and then someone has to build it in real life, not for the movie, but for the theme park, right?
Well, that's absolutely right. Movies are one of the ways in which we tell stories and engage in like mythologizing, right? And these theme parks give us the opportunity to go experience the mythology, you know, to somehow participate in a shared experience of inhabiting these places.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of fascinating how much of that has crept in. And then it sort of becomes this novel thing where a movie says, well, and we did all the effects practically. You know, we'd actually blew things up. And we recently has been a thing where, you know, they drove for a Tom Cruise film. They drove a train off of a cliff and actually did it. Instead of it, you know, the beginnings of visual effects was the other way around, that the novel thing was to have kind of done it as a as an effect and not as a kind of practical effect. So, we could talk about film for ages, actually, because that's, you know, I studied film. That's where I kind of, I wanted to be a film director, and visual effects were initially my thing. It's been interesting for me to see Unreal's engine, actually, has been used now as a kind of visual effects backdrop thing. And it's to do with the resolution of screens as well. So they have these huge screens that are acting as the kind of matte painting or the backgrounds, what would have been the kind of set flats, the things that kind of a fake, you know, background was painted on. A little bit of kind of set, you know, in the foreground. And basically, then the camera is rigged, as you probably know this, right? The camera is then set up with a VR head on it so that the computer knows where it is in space and is adjusting the background. So the camera can move around and the background also moves around. And it's just amazing because there's like a huge screen over the top or lighting over the top and then the sides, and then say, okay, right, can we have it light nighttime now or a sunset? And the whole thing kind of just switches around. It is quite remarkable. And because of the depth of field, you don't see the background, just looks real. Right? It blurs out enough.
Yeah, the first time I heard about that was with the production of The Mandalorian.
Exactly, right? That was a famous one, yeah.
Yeah. It might seem like we're going down a tangent, but really this is about placemaking, right? Like you're creating an environment that is going to serve as a context for, in the case of the movies, for a particular story to unfold. In the case of our work and daily life, it's where things happen. It's where we live out our lives, right? And the places are where we interact with each other, where we accomplish the things that we set out to accomplish. And we can structure them purposefully to help us do that or not, right?
Yeah. And we've all had this experience, right? I think I've worked remotely for quite a long time, and you probably have done as well. But I think, you know, the rest of the world in the last 2 years has just experienced what it means to be literally living in information, right? To quote the title of your book, of all of a sudden, you know, I think it's been fascinating to see that all the usual excuses of why you can't do stuff, you know, suddenly kind of, you know, fell away, and watch people engage. In my early days of doing sort of remote workshops, there was an awful lot of stuff of, this is how you use Mural or Miro. This is how you kind of set up Zoom. Don't forget to, you know, and now everyone knows that stuff. The sort of social etiquette of being on mute and all of those kinds of things of, and I recently did a thing and there was like an icebreaker exercise and I was expecting to have to explain things a bit more and everyone just, you know, cracked into it straight away because they're just so used to it. And I'm really always fascinated about the way that technology goes through this arc where, you know, it's this different thing. Then it's a little bit clunky. It doesn't really quite yet fit with how we interact as humans. And then we develop, I think, etiquette around it is the way I'm thinking. I like to think about it. I still think one of the things, I've written about this before, one of the things that's a little bit strange, like say with a Zoom conversation or, you know, video call, is how you say goodbye. It doesn't have the same, it's a little bit awkward because you don't ever do that in real life. You don't sort of just, it's not like a screen comes down between you two and then suddenly you're not connected anymore. You would walk to the door and say goodbye and then, you know, and all that stuff and turn your back to each other and stuff. But, you know, I'm also think back to the early days of the telephone and kind of the how people got used to actually to telephoning and how to kind of say hello and how to say goodbye and stuff. And so it's been fascinating to watch that become more every day, I think, in the last couple of years.
Yeah. And I'm sure that the early days of the automobile, for example, there wouldn't be all of the standards that we take for granted now. Like, I'm thinking of like driving on one side of the road, right?
Yeah.
Like that's something that had to emerge. And I don't know the history of this. It might be that it was imposed from the top down, but I would imagine that for practical reasons, people must self-organize to keep themselves from getting into jams.
Yeah, you know?
In the case of traffic, quite literal jams, right?
So in your book, you were talking about living in information. What's the kind of, well, now it's, well, when did you write it? Or it came out, I think, 2018, right? So it's had a few years now. There's always this thing, especially with a book like that, where you're sort of capturing a moment in time. What's the kind of general thesis of the book? And how's your sort of thesis or thinking about that evolved since you wrote it? You know, what would you love to have written or added into it or changed?
The genesis of the book is the Northern Hemisphere summer and the fall of 2016, which was a period of political uncertainty and turmoil. It's when Brexit happened in the UK and then the election in the US, which was very polarized, very contentious. And if you followed, especially if you followed the mainstream media, I think that the result was unexpected.
Yeah, yeah.
And surprising to a lot of people. And there was a perception at the time, this was happening in no small part because we had moved all these key civic conversations and also our news gathering. We had moved it to these spaces that are monetized by selling our attention. And that seemed to me to be incompatible with having transparent and even keeled conversations about policy, you know, about the things that make a society tick. So that was the genesis of that. What has changed since then? I think that people have become much more aware of this issue. Like, there's even a Netflix documentary series, which I haven't seen.
Which one?
I think it's called The Social Dilemma.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right, yeah, yeah.
Which deals with these types of issues, right? The conversation has become a lot more mainstream. I think that there's been research that's come to the fore, both for and against this position since I wrote the book. I still believe that the core argument of the book is sound, which is that the incentive structures that drive the places where we engage in conversation will influence the form that that conversation takes.
Right.
And I don't know that we have made much progress since then in that regard.
It wasn't really adequately thought about in the first place. I guess that's the most obvious one is that thing of kind of extremist views on, you know, or posts on Facebook get the most engagement and thus the most advertising dollars for Facebook. And, you know, it's structurally set up that way all the time while kind of, you know, Mark Zuckerberg saying, you know, we've got the largest amount of experts, you know, tackling disinformation, but they've got a far larger amount of experts tackling how to make that engagement pay. So it's just, you know, it's a never ending, well, it's just something that can never be kind of finished unless you completely restructure it. So I guess that's, you know, probably the example that most people will think of. It's interesting you mentioned The Social Dilemma. I started watching it. I just wanted to kind of punch everyone, I have to say, on it, because there was mostly men sort of there saying, yeah, you know, we just didn't really kind of think anyone was going to use it this way. And I was really shocked. And I just, I had this kind of response to it of, how could you possibly not have at least gone through the exercise of thinking, how might someone use this nefariously? You know, because that seems to be a fundamental, it's my favorite critique tactic with my students is, you know, they've got a service concept in front of them. I'm there saying, well, you know, what happens if I do this? And what happens if I do that? How about if I break this? And then they're like, oh, but we don't think people would do that. But of course, someone will. And it's a very good way of stress testing these ephemeral things that would, you know, in architecture, actual architecture, but and also in industrial design. That's what you do. You know, you make a prototype, not just because it's sort of a nice thing to look at, but you make a prototype to put it through, to smash it up and to see where it breaks and stuff, right? See if it's dangerous. But the kind of digital tools and services out there and platforms, they don't really go through that.
And it's ironic because prototyping in digital space is so much easier than prototyping in, physical stuff, right?
Yeah, much cheaper too, right?
It's cheaper, it scales much faster. And surprisingly also, digital requires a systems mindset. Like you have to understand how all of these things fit together in order to build these things. So it's surprising, to your point, it's surprising that the people who make these things don't engage in second and third order thinking when they build them.
It's equivalent, though, I think, to, you know, watchmaker understanding how all the cogs and springs and parts fit together, but not really interested in what does it mean when people can carry around a device that tells the time all the time? How does that shape our daily rhythms and so on? And, you know, and famously, as you, I'm sure you know, the watch was a kind of artifact of the railroads, right? Because once you have things running on a schedule, then people have to know. They can't just say, oh, I'll be there at noon or when the, you know, sun is in the sky. You have to know exactly what the time is in order to catch the train and the rest of it. So that kind of system side of it, I don't think comes in that much at all.
Yeah.
And our, you know, I guess our lack of teaching for that in school, our lack of kind of thinking in that way, both economically and also kind of in the workplace, you know, leads to all the other problems like, you know, sustainability and climate change and the rest of it.
You know, I'm thinking one other thing that has evolved for me since I wrote the book, and it's not that it's new for me. It's something that it's been part of my thinking for a long time, but I've just been kind of leaning into it, is the notion that there are information environments, which is the phrase that I use in the book, and it's a phrase that comes from the information architecture community, as far as I'm aware. It might be, have been used earlier, but that's where I became aware of it. And there are information environments that are designed for public use, for public discussion, as we're talking about here. And you have to be very mindful of those, obviously. The effects of creating a system that allows people to have discussions at the level of an entire society, is there's tremendous power there. But these systems can also be used personally, at a personal level, right?
Yeah.
And you and I have both talked about this metaphor of the garden, which is such a great metaphor. And it's one that that for me resonates greatly. It first resonated with me through the work of Brian Eno, who I know you're also familiar with.
Yeah.
And the reason that I got attracted to Eno's usage is that he contrasted architecture with gardening. Right, he said that there's this notion that in architecture that what you're doing is you're structuring a system from the top down. You're saying, well, this is how it should be, and I'm going to put the conditions in place that are going to serve this particular set of needs, this program, and I am the expert, and I know how to do this. I've been trained to do this, so I'm going to bring my expertise to bear on this problem space. And then the people who use the system will be the beneficiaries of that hard-earned knowledge. And that's one worldview, right, of how these systems get designed.
Yeah.
But Eno contrasts that approach, what he calls the architectural approach, with gardening, which is the notion that you structure the system not with the intent of making it right from the get-go, but with the intent of setting up the conditions that will make it possible for the system to evolve into something that meets the needs of the gardener or the society or what have you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's this kind of top-down versus bottom-up approach.
And so I think it's probably significant that a musician kind of comes at it from that angle as well, because I think working in music or composing music or this creation of quite a lot of kind of artistic artifacts is much more of a, you know, people like to think it's a masterful act of creation from the top down, but it's much more of a kind of feeling out of, you know, what is here and trying to sort of draw out some aspects whilst kind of clip back others. So I'm not surprised that, you know, took that kind of view.
But not all musicians, right? And he's talked about the classical Western musical forms, this notion that Beethoven goes off and composes a symphony, which gets articulated in a set of documents that the orchestra then goes to perform.
Yeah,
and the idea behind those documents is to capture as precisely as possible the intent of the composer, right?
Yeah.
And when you perform the symphony, you're trying to hue as closely as possible to the vision of the creator. And if you contrast that with jazz, for example, where the musicians are working within a structure for sure, but it's a structure that allows for improvisation, happy accidents, riffing, you know, and in ideal conditions, a new thing will emerge every time that you're listening to it. And in some ways, listening to a recording is kind of like going against the grain of the
of what music actually is,
or what it is. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right.
I have some recordings of, I'm a saxophonist. Well, I'm not really anymore, but I used to be a saxophonist. And I have some recordings of Charlie Parker sessions and also some John Coltrane sessions where you get the outtakes as well. You get the multiple takes of it. And it's very fascinating because, well, it was very fascinating. It was two reasons. One, because there's a bit where someone was recording when Charlie Parker was practicing. And it's, I mean, it's obviously very good, but it's kind of also he's making loads of mistakes, and he's kind of then slows down and then practice, you know, and you hear this person who you only in a recording hear this snapshot of this kind of moments of brilliance, the polished version. But actually to hear him getting there was really kind of fascinating, and quite heartening. But also, you know, and in particularly someone like John Coltrane and his kind of, you know, sheets of sound and stuff, to hear the different takes, and it's like, I don't know, throwing down the clay on the kind of potter's wheel each time. It's like, oh, that one came out pretty well. Let's use that one. But there are some multiple other versions of it that they could have chosen for whatever reason. You know, it's always really great. And it's the same way we talked about film. You know, there's all these, it's always really fascinated me. The, you know, deleted scenes or the bits, these moments when the director in the sort of commentary is saying, this scene was fantastic. It's a really beautiful bit of acting. You can tell they're sort of enjoying being able to show it finally. And then they just say, but you know, ultimately it didn't really drive the story along, so we had to cut it. And there's this kind of that kill your darlings thing of like, you know, we're going to get rid of this thing that is actually a kind of amazing piece of artistry, because it doesn't drive this other piece of artistry that we're trying to achieve.
You know, we were ragging earlier on social media, but one of the wonderful things about social media is that the way that we would share ideas in the past was that the ideas would have to go through this gauntlet of gatekeepers, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All the way up to the point where it gets published as a book or gets made into a movie or what have you. And it's like this very formal artifact that cost a lot of money and took a lot of time and a lot of effort. And it didn't give us as much opportunity to riff and to improvise and to try different things, to make mistakes, right? And I've come to think of social media. I actually drew a pace layer diagram at one point with, if the listeners are familiar with pace layers, this notion that complex systems change, are composed of things that change at different rates. So some parts of the system change faster than others, and the layers influence each other. So the faster changing layers inform slower changing layers and such. I'm not doing the concept justice, but I drew a pace layer diagram that had social media in the faster changing layer and things like books in the slower changing layers, with the idea that I see social media as a place where you can go and try out ideas that are half-baked, and sketchy and incomplete. And then you put them out into the world and iterate. You know, we're talking about prototyping. It's like prototyping for ideas at a very kind of granular level.
Yeah.
And it's been amazing for me in that area. That's another way in which my thinking has evolved since I wrote Living in Information, that I'm trying to find a way to fit all of these systems that we're living with into my own kind of production function, which is a phrase I picked up from the economist Tyler Cowen, which I love, this idea that we all have tools, processes, habits that allow us to do what we do, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel much better about my own use of these systems than I did back in 2016, because I understand them for what they can do for me and for my thinking much better.
So this neatly brings us on to the idea of, you know, personal knowledge systems or information gardens. Now, you and I have been kind of going back and forth a little bit as well about an app called Obsidian. And I have to kind of rewind a little bit. So for people who kind of write, and writers have done this for a very long time, the idea of kind of, you know, a day, what's it called? Is it a day book? Where you kind of write down stuff that you've learned about in the day. It's got another name. I know. I can't think of it. You will know it probably.
A commonplace book?
Yeah, commonplace book. Thank you. Yeah. But also, you know, if you're doing research and if you're, you know, you're trying to capture all the stuff and capture your notes and your ideas about things, there's been lots of different ways of doing it. Famously, a Zettelkasten, which in German, it means a box of notes. A Zettel is like a slip of, you know, paper, like an index card or a slip of paper. And I've used lots of different tools. I've tried to remain kind of plain text for a long time and keep my own, you know, keep my own data. I had a different system. I used to use a thing called NV Alt and then NV Ultra to do this anyway. Obsidian allows you to, it's basically, you write everything in plain text and it's in Markdown, and then you're able to kind of wiki link it together. But it's got a few other kind of powerful things around, because there's a big plugin infrastructure to it, or community around it, of people writing these plugins to do sort of cool things about how you start to see the hidden connections between the information. And I saw you wrote about it the other day as well. You're using it. So tell me a little bit about why you do this and have your kind of own information garden, and what you see it is, and how you sort of go about thinking about it.
I spoke earlier about my obsession with computers from a very early age. And that obsession started with video games, with computers as entertainment. And it became evident at some point, and I can't pinpoint exactly when, but it became evident to me that they were useful for more than that, right? Like, I knew that things like VisiCalc and you know, spreadsheets and stuff like that existed, and that people were using these things for uses other than playing games. But computers are obviously much more than that. And there's this analogy that Steve Jobs made famous, this notion that computers are bicycles for the mind,
yeah,
that they allow us to do things that we would not be able to do before, in much the same way that a bicycle allows us to leverage our body's energy very powerfully, right? And the thing with tools like Obsidian is that analogy about computers being bicycles for the mind, think about all the types of different bicycles there are, right? So you can put them on a spectrum, and in one end of the spectrum, you have Pee Wee Herman's bicycle from Pee Wee's Big Adventure, if you've seen that movie, right?
Is it one of those that sort of goes weirdly up and down and stuff? I can't remember it, actually.
I forget the name of it, but it's like a 1950s style, big, bulky, flashy bicycle.
Like a sort of chopper type thing.
Yeah, and it's kind of tacky looking and kind of fun. And, you know, and it's clearly a bicycle that's been designed to draw attention to itself and to be entertaining, right?
Yeah.
And in the opposite end of the spectrum, you might have the sort of bicycle that someone who is competing in the Tour de France would use, right?
Yeah.
Those are all bicycles, but they're very different from each other, right? And they're designed with different purposes in mind. And I think that for people who live during the time that we're living in, having access to these amazing tools, we have, I was going to say responsibility, but I don't know that it's a responsibility. It's more like we have the ability, the wherewithal, to decide which type of bicycle we want to use. What is our relationship going to be to these technologies that are a part of our reality? And we can choose to employ them to entertain us, to help us while away the time, and to do some basic things like, I don't know, transfer money in our bank accounts or keep in touch with our friends and family, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But these things also give us the ability to greatly expand our knowledge and to live richer, more fuller, more meaningful lives. And I am very interested in using them for that purpose, for the purpose of living a better life, which for me means the life of the mind, but the life of the mind as it helps me act more skillfully in the world. So it's not like philosophizing for the purpose of, I don't know, sounding clever or what have you. It's becoming informed so that we can act more skillfully. We were talking earlier about politics, right? There's so much chatter happening about political stuff that comes from a position of reaction to what you read in the media, reaction to what you hear other people saying, versus becoming truly informed about the subject and studying the history of what happened here, what led to these conditions. And it's possible to do so much more so than it's ever been for humans on this planet. You know, we have these amazing technologies. We have the internet. We have the internet in our pocket, for heaven's sake, you know, and we take it for granted. And I don't want to take it for granted. I want to be very intentional in how I grow as an individual by being augmented by these technologies. So that's how I see it.
Okay, so tell me what an information garden is. How do you, you write your newsletter with much more dedication than I do. Mine's always been billed as an occasional, irregular newsletter. And in fact, there's one that I need to finish off. But you're very kind of regular with it. You're also kind of pulling together or drawing together these different threads. What's the kind of workflow for you, or kind of thought flow maybe is a better, or information flow perhaps, in terms of, you know, how you go about connecting these things that you're finding together? How do you then sort of make notes, as it were, about them, and why do you do it in this way?
Yeah, that's a great prompt. You talked about Obsidian, and Obsidian has become a part of that tool set, and we can talk about the tools in particular. But first, I'll talk about it at a high level. I see what I'm doing happening on two levels. On one level, it's reactive, which is finding a way to make note of, capture, annotate, keep track of things that come to my attention, which I find interesting or important or what have you. We are exposed to so much stuff just in the act of like going around in our daily lives, right? If we're working on a project, there's all sorts of information coming at you from that project. If you open Twitter or what have you, you're all of a sudden you have this, you know, fire hose of stuff coming at you.
Yeah.
A lot of it is just not relevant, but some of it might resonate, might be important to you. It might just be interesting. And if you don't find a way of capturing it, there's so much coming at you and it's so fast that the moment will pass and you'll likely drop it, right? So that's one level, the kind of reactive, like,
yeah,
just trying to capture what I have coming at me. And the other is more proactive, which is I have certain topics that I am interested in, that I am working on at any given moment, and I'm doing research for those things. And my research yields notes, things that have resonated with me, things that I want to follow up on. And again, as with the reactive stuff, if you don't capture that stuff, there's so much out there that it will pass, at least for me. Like, I don't have a very good memory. So if I don't capture the stuff, it gets lost. And I've long had systems that allow me to do that. There have been note-taking applications forever.
Yeah, yeah.
The difference now, and I think that we are living in a special moment for this, the difference now is that there is a crop of tools in the market that make manifest some of the early visions of what computers could do for us. You know, this notion of hypertext is not new, right?
Yeah,
Ted
yeah.
Nelson and folks like that have been writing and talking about this stuff since at least the 1960s. But now there's a crop of tools that make a lot of these ideas usable, you know, and make them easier to use.
Yeah.
And Obsidian is one of them. DevonThink is another. And what I do is I'm always kind of on the lookout for things, whether they come at me or whether I have sought them out. And I put them into the system, which is always evolving, this kind of personal garden. And one part of the garden has Obsidian for note-taking. And the other key part of the garden for me right now is DevonThink, which is kind of an everything bucket where I drop hyperlinks and PDFs and stuff like that. And it's an app that uses artificial intelligence, machine learning, that sort of stuff, to suggest possible connections between items so that it might spot that a certain PDF might be relevant to you if you are interested in the thing that you're currently examining, it might be a web page or what have you. And all of a sudden, you can surface connections between ideas in your repository in a way that that would be difficult, time-consuming for you without this technological augmentation.
And so I'm interested in this part of, because we started off talking about how sort of technology influences then when we live in information, just like architecture, you know, the famous McLuhan thing of which, you know, was coined by his friend of, you know, we shape our tools and thereafter they shape us, was originally said by Churchill, I believe, around buildings, right? We shape our buildings and thereafter they shape us. And this idea that I'm, you know, using a tool, but the tool is, if not using me, it's certainly kind of shaping my way of thinking. And I noticed that you mentioned before, there's a nice piece you wrote recently about a generation of people who kind of don't really get the whole file or folder mental model, you know, and I think it's, you're quoting Monica Chin in The Verge, and there's a quote from her, it says, directory structure isn't just unintuitive to students, it's so intuitive to professors that they have difficulty figuring out how to explain it. And I'm kind of interested in then how these tools like this, where you're getting assistance in the case of Dev and Think, you know, to connect things together. But, and at the same time, you're also then revealing, it's something like Obsidian is revealing connections that you have made, but you've kind of made in the course of your sort of, you know, entering notes and linking things together without explicitly sort of trying to kind of create necessarily a graph. And what you're looking for are the kind of emergent things. Right. And so hence, I'm guessing the garden metaphor, right, where you're sort of saying, well, over here, you know, I know it's sunny over here, so I'm going to plant these kinds of things. Or, you know, perhaps those kind of microclimate sort of gardens or those things where you plant sort of one herb next to some other plant because you know that herb repels a certain kind of insect that normally, you know, attack that other vegetable or whatever. And so there's things like that going on. But then there's also these kind of emergent things that happen because obviously plants grow, you know, based on a whole bunch of different kind of environmental forces. So that you end up in this situation where you're kind of seeing connections that you, or connections are revealed that you hadn't initially thought of. And I'm interested to know whether you've had a kind of moment like this where, you know, there was something that you hadn't really realized was connected. And by the use of these tools, you had a kind of aha moment of like, oh, there's a relationship between these things.
It does happen. I don't have any that comes immediately to mind. A lot of them might be too trivial to spin a good story around.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it does happen. And it happens even without the augmentation of something like Dev and Think or Obsidian, right? Like just the notion of putting stuff down sets in process this feedback loop that allows your own mind to make connections, right? What these tools are doing is they are greatly expanding the scope of what the process can include. And my reaction to the McLuhan quote is that it might contain a false duality. This notion that there are tools and there are us, I think is suspect, because in this case, I believe that these tools are us in the sense that they augment our minds. And our mind is not something that is contained, you know, within the little meat computer that I have here on top of my shoulders. It's something that includes elements of the world around it. I'm reading this fabulous book right now called The Extended Mind by Annie Murphy-Paul, right, that talks about the various ways in which we think with our environments, with our tools, with other people. And these tools are in some ways me, right? Like you were talking about a blog post that I published recently. And the blog post is a way for you to know what I'm thinking. You know, I'm fortunate to think of you as a friend and to be able to talk with you over Zoom like we're doing now. I have a lot of relationships with people on the internet where there is a relationship, but it's not a relationship like the one we're having where we're talking one-on-one. It's a relationship where I'm publishing something and they're reading it. Mm-hmm. And they get a sense of who I am through the words that I'm putting out there. And those words didn't come just from the meat computer, you know. They came from this system that I've set up that includes tools like Obsidian and Dev and Think. And these tools become part of the system, the function, the process that makes these ideas manifest in the world.
Yeah.
So it might be worth questioning whether that's a valid distinction.
My PhD was about sort of interactivity and play, and as I looked into it, I went deeply into the whole kind of metaphor thing as well, and Lakoff and Johnson, and the phenomenologist view that you experience the world through your body. You don't experience the world through your mind, right? You process what your body signals to your mind, but there's a Cartesian view of kind of I think, well, therefore I am. I'm somehow a kind of separate consciousness from my body is an illusion. Right? And it was very important for me to kind of be thinking around metaphors and interaction, and this idea that there's this weird moment where they collapse into each other sometimes. And Lakoff and Johnson, in their famous book of Metaphors We Live By, you know, talk a lot about this with language. And as they sort of pull apart language, you realize you can barely speak without using metaphors. And I've just said pull apart language as if language is a thing that, you know, is made out of building blocks. I can pull it apart and all of those kinds of stuff. We just, once you get there, you're like, can barely speak because there's, so you go, oh, hang on a second. Oh, no, I've just used another metaphor, right? Even the idea, using a metaphor as if it's a tool and all those things. And what I was interested in was with sort of digital devices, and it was just at the, I wrote my PhD just as the kind of iPhone was coming out, was this collapsing of metaphors where when you pull a file, let's say, into the wastebasket, you know it's a metaphor, right? It's a visual metaphor of you doing that. It's not really you pulling a file in the wastebasket. But, you know, when you delete that stuff and you say you empty the wastebasket, you will feel exactly the same kind of emotional response if you've accidentally done that to the wrong file as if you had actually thrown something in the bin in real life. And there's a kind of physicality to kind of dragging it into the wastebasket sometimes as well. There's all these kind of things where as soon as touchscreens came out, some of those things collapsed. And yet you're still actually in kind of metaphor land, because when I'm, you know, zooming in and out of a photo, it amazes me that that feels so intuitive, because there isn't really anything in real life that feels like that, right? It would have to be a photo sort of printed on latex and you were kind of somehow kind of stretching it, because what you're doing is just making little pinching motions on a pane of glass, and yet it kind of feels like it's really intuitive. So I'm always interested where the fabric of that metaphor, if you like, right, to use another one, is so thin that we kind of barely recognize it's there. And I think that's what people mean when they say this interface is so intuitive. And then you kind of realize how much that's just a learnt behavior, right? And so that article that you mentioned just shows that kind of generational split between people who are used to just Googling the big mess of the internet for stuff and people who are used to this idea of carefully collecting and curating information and putting it in files and folders and stuff like that. And I'm kind of always interested then when these kind of new tools come out and become a kind of dominant paradigm. And at the moment, you know, we're on the cusp of, I feel like we're sort of, there's a whole load of them jostling for position at the moment. But it really does shape the way you think about going about something. And I'm wondering if, to go back to the nature metaphor, whether this is akin, and we were talking about this a bit before, between, you know, say, subsistence farming or farming as it was in medieval times versus kind of industrial farming now versus a botanical garden, which serves this kind of utility function as well as a function of kind of beauty, versus something that's like a, you know, a, well, I sometimes drive past, you know, crops that have got, you know, fields that have got those little, a little kind of stake with a sign in front of it, you know, list with some kind of gobbledygook on it, which is, they're obviously different strains of some kind of seed or something that are being tested, and this very, very kind of scientific way of thinking about those things. And whether that's a kind of, that's just the way it is, you know, that you use these different tools in different ways, or there's something more fundamental in the fact that we all carry around a computer in our pocket that's connected to this vast store of information.
There's a lot there.
There wasn't a question in there.
Well, no, there's several threads we could pull on. There's a metaphor. Having a computer in your pocket that gives you access to a lot of the world's information is a deeply transformational fact about the current world. I think that we don't appreciate how weird and transformational it is because we're living it.
Yeah.
But we still don't know really what the effects are of doing that at scale, right? Giving everyone access to all this stuff ubiquitously. And I think that it's safe to assume that it's a period that has a lot of turmoil. Like you can't introduce a major change like that without expecting some kind of turmoil. And we as individuals have to determine how we engage with the world in which we live. Some people choose to reject it, right? Like they'll say, I want no part of this. This is so weird. This is messing with my mojo, you know, what have you. Yeah. I will have no part of it. I will revert to using a flip phone or no phone at all. I want nothing to do with the internet. I will only read paper-based books. I mean, there's many, many ways in which you can reject it, right?
Yeah.
You can embrace it. I think that we've been talking about embracing it. Mm-hmm. You can embrace it. You can choose to play. If you choose to play, you have to be conscious about how you're going to be playing and what that's going to do to you. And I think that we have to work on ourselves at several levels. On one level, we have to work on how we engage with these technologies, how we make better use of them, all the stuff that we've been talking about. But on another level, we have to work on how we think of ourselves as actors in the world, like our mindset, right?
Yeah.
And I'm saying this because this idea of the metaphors that we use is a great illustration of this. So one of the things that's happening, because technology changes so fast and it's affecting so much change in its wake, is that the metaphors that we've been using for a long time have become unstable. Mm. And if you are caught in a metaphor, if you somehow feel like the metaphor is the way things are, you are going to be less able to navigate the changes that are coming at you. You're going to be less resilient, frankly, because the metaphors are going to be changing. Mm-hmm. You were alluding to this article about file systems, right?
Yeah.
That's an example of that. And we are in the process of dematerializing a lot of our experiences, a lot of our interactions. You've seen this meme that goes around with the scan from the Radio Shack catalog and all of the products that the iPhone replaced, right?
Yeah, yeah.
When that happens, you end up with icons that represent floppy disks,
yeah.
Meaning save, right? And no one remembers what a floppy disk was, but yeah. It's like the icon now suddenly like contains that meaning. So my point is, we can work on our abilities at dealing with specific technologies. Like I'll learn Obsidian, I'll learn DevonThink or what have you. But we must also work on our ability to change in response to those technologies and our ability to keep our system open to new ways of being in the world, which these tools demand. Right? Like you can't expect the world not to change when you're dealing with these technologies.
With that comes the idea that, you know, you're aware that it's going on, right? That we're part of these, the kind of interplay between the two. Maybe we're just getting old now. We talked about our age earlier of kind of, you know, kids today don't realize that they're doing it. And maybe it's the same. Or maybe the kids today are like, yeah, of course, you know, that's just there. Of course, the internet is just there. I'm going to have this experience, my 12-year-old daughter, and I was saying something the other day about, oh, no, you can't do that because we're not online. And she was like, what does that mean? It's like radio waves in the air or something. She doesn't, which of course they are, but, you know, she doesn't really kind of think of, the internet's just a thing that's there for her. You know, the idea that it's not there is like saying, because there's no sun in the sky today, and it just starts to not make any sense. There's loads more we could talk about. There's a whole lot of music stuff that we could talk about too, but we're coming up to time. It's been a long and very interesting conversation. I can only recommend that people subscribe to your newsletter, listen to your podcast for more of the deep thinking. Where do people find you in this digital information garden that we all inhabit?
The best place is my website. It's jarango.com, so jarango.com. I'm also fairly active on Twitter, and I'm at jarango there. So yeah, I'd love to engage with y'all on either of those.
Excellent. I'll put it all in the show notes. Listen, thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
It's always a pleasure talking with you, Andy.
As I'm sure you're aware, you've been listening to Power of 10. My name is Andy Pullane. You can find me at apullane on Twitter or pullane.com, where you can find more episodes and sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you like the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. It really helps others find us. And as always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.